Well, good morning. So glad each and every one of you are here this morning. It's not a bright sunny day, but it's a wonderful day. So glad you're here. We have been talking all month about characters from the Old Testament, and it's been an adventure. Today is King David, and we know that his name means beloved, so the whole theme is love, you know, just trying to do that. David happens to be one of my favorite characters from the Old Testament. I, in fact, wrote my paper in ministerial school on David. I think his story is inspiring and interesting, beautiful. So we're going to take a look at him. Like Moses, you know, that his story spanned all those books of the Bible. I think I told you, you know, they went from Exodus all the way up to Joshua. All those books included Moses' story. Well, David's story starts in 1 Samuel, finishes 1 Samuel, goes all the way through 2 Samuel, and he's still alive at the beginning of 1 Kings. But he's a very old man by that time. So there's a lot of information about David. We probably aren't going to cover, well, we are for sure not, I'm not going to cover all of it. I mean, you can go back and read some of it if you like. There's a lot of information about him. I hope that we will have a chance to just, you know, take some looks at some of the major pieces of his story and see how they apply to us. David was actually the second king. We remember from the story of Moses that Moses freed the Hebrews from the bondage of the Egyptians, and they went out into the wilderness, if you recall, and they were a nomadic people then. They'd wandered, you know, through the wilderness. When Joshua took them into the Promised Land, they became a tribal society. There were 12 tribes, and they each were kind of autonomous, you know, they were independent, but still one people. And it was through that period we talked about Deborah. She was one of the judges. There were 14 judges. So whenever a judge wasn't the same as it is today, it was a military ruler often, and it was someone who would deliver the people out of the oppression of some neighboring country who had conquered them at that time. So there were 14 of these judges. The last one was Samuel. And that's really kind of where our story picks up today, is with Samuel. The people had begun to say, "We want a king." And God told, you know, Samuel went and talked to God, and God said, "I'm the king. Tell him I'm the king." And all of this is my paraphrasing. Okay, it doesn't really say that like this, but so he went back to Samuel went back to the people and told them what God said, and they said, "We still want a king. We really want a king." So back and forth, back and forth. So finally God said, "Okay, fine, I'll give you a king." He chose Saul. We haven't talked much about Saul. I'm just going to touch, you know, on him, but he's pretty integral to David's story. So God said, "This is the man I want you to anoint," and it was Saul. And at that time, it sounded like Saul was a very big man, tall. He apparently towered over, you know, many of the other people around, men around, good looking, said he was handsome. And I guess he had had some success in military operations or whatever. And so he was the anointed one. Things went along okay for a little while, but Saul listened really too much to the people and what they wanted and what they said they needed. And so when they said, "We need to go into battle," there was one time in particular that Saul was waiting for Samuel to come to offer a sacrifice so that they could go into battle. Whenever God anoints a person, then Scripture says, "And the Spirit of the Lord came over him." So then you know that the Spirit is with that person. And when the Spirit is with that person, they're generally very successful in battle, and they do well. Saul did well at the beginning. But like I said, he was listening to these other people. They were getting ready to go into battle again. They wanted to offer have a burnt sacrifice to ensure success in the battle. And Samuel wasn't there. And they waited, and Samuel didn't come and didn't come and didn't come. And finally Saul said, "Okay, I'll just do it." And he did. And just not long after that, Samuel showed up and said, "What have you done?" And apparently God was very displeased that Saul had done that. That is not something that Saul was told to do by God or by Samuel. That is something that was supposed to be just Samuel's to do. Samuel is the kind of like the priest, you know, kind of person. God was very displeased and so told Samuel that he was taking the kingship away from Saul, and he wanted Samuel to go and seek out this person that God wanted him to seek out. So Samuel did. He told Saul, God was pretty unhappy with you, and you aren't going to be king anymore. So he sent him out. Now, Samuel didn't know who he was looking for, but God sent him to a man named Jesse. Excuse me. Jesse had several sons, and God said, have Jesse bring these sons before you. So one at a time they would come, and God would say, that's not him. Okay, so another son. Nope, that's not him either. So all of the sons that Jesse had rounded up had come before him, and Samuel said, are these all of your sons? Jesse said, well, there is one more. I have a boy out in the meadow in the field. He's tending our flocks right now. And Samuel said, well, can you have him come in? Bring him here. He did, and it was David. And God said, this is the one. So right then, Samuel anointed David to be the next chosen king. And he's a young guy. He's still a boy. He's not grown yet. But he's anointed. And when he is anointed, then God took away it said the Spirit of God departed from Saul, and a demon took possession of Saul. When you read through the account, the behavior of Saul then and in further descriptions, it sounds much like what we would call mental disorder. You know, I think he's kind of just not right. So now Saul is not, he doesn't have God with him anymore. David does. And things move on. So Saul is being tormented, it says. And what that looks like is apparently he gets like headaches, and he's very anxious, and just nothing will soothe him. Some of his attendants said, well, you know, if you could find someone that plays the lyre, it's a musical instrument, that might help. So Saul said, that would be great. It turns out that David was really good at the lyre. Saul summoned David to the palace, I guess, wherever he lived. And David played for him, and Saul loved the music. It did, in fact, make him feel much better. He was able to calm down, and his pain went away, and so he really liked David's playing. And in fact, asked David to just, you know, kind of stay, be here, so that whenever I'm feeling bad, then I could call you. So that's what they did. And it says that they came to love each other. It said that Saul came to love David. David came to love Saul. David loved Saul. He loved his son, Jonathan. He loved, well, later, Saul even gave his daughter, Michal, in marriage to David. So it was pretty tight-knit. Except then, when you read the next passage, which is about Goliath, we've heard about Goliath, and in there, David had been sent to the field with supplies or something like that, and there in the field was a huge Philistine soldier. It said he was, I don't know, so many cubits, about 10 feet tall, great big guy. And he had all this armor, and he was very formidable looking and sounding. He was issuing a challenge to anyone who would take him on. He said, I'll fight you, you know, and there were conditions for who would, if you know, if you win, then we'll go away. You know, nobody would take him up, though, because his, well, can you imagine? Even today, people are bigger today than they used to be. Even now, 10 feet tall would be scary. Nobody would go forward. So here's this guy, this giant Goliath. David had brought these provisions, and he happened to see Goliath. Now God is with David because he's been anointed. David knows that he needs to go up against Goliath and it's going to be okay. So he goes to Saul, and Saul says, "Oh, but you're just a boy." You know? David said, I know, but God is with me. I know this is going to be good or fine, whatever he said. So Saul tries to give him armor, but he's too small. You know, the armor just weighs him down. He can't move. He can't function with the armor. So he said, "No, I can't use that." He just picks up a few rocks, puts them in his little bag. He's got his slingshot. We've all heard about the story. And he tells the giant, Goliath, he said, "I'm going to kill you, and then I'm going to cut your head off." He goes out and with his slingshot aims, and the rock hits Goliath right in the center of the forehead, knocks him out, and David goes over and with Goliath's own sword, kills him, cuts his head off. So he is... It's amazing to everyone and Saul. And then, this is the part that I was kind of confused by. Saul asks, "Whose son are you?" And I read it and I thought, wait a minute. But in my study Bible, it says that was one of the indications that Saul wasn't quite all there, that his demons would cause him to forget. And so he just totally lost track of who David was. David answered respectfully, "I am Jesse's son." And so that sort of begins the time when David begins his military operations. And God being with him, he is successful everywhere he goes, in all the battles. And he becomes sort of famous, and he becomes beloved, as his name implies. He is a fair leader. He said that he would go into battle and the spoils, he would have the spoils divided among the, not only the soldiers that were out there with them, but the ones that had stayed back too. So he was very fair. He got quite a reputation. And through his efforts, the kingdom expanded, because his military conquest made it so that the kingdom got bigger. Saul got very jealous because people were talking about David and how wonderful he was and all these battles that he had won, and the people were really loving it, and Saul was getting more and more jealous. Saul had already been and was really seriously trying to kill David. He was not right. He just was not right. Jonathan, that I mentioned, his son, Saul's son, saved David several times. They were right there in the castle, and Jonathan knew that his father was going to try and kill David, so David was able to escape. Through all of that, Saul pursuing him, ambushing him, all of that, David never retaliated. He never tried to hurt him back. He just continued to evade him, but he never did anything against Saul. There was one story about David and his army being in a cave. They were kind of hiding in a cave back in the recesses of it. And Saul came in, I think, to relieve himself. But he was, and David's soldiers wanted him to kill him. Said, "This is our chance. Let's just have this done with." And Saul and David wouldn't do it. What he did do was he snuck up and he cut off a piece of Saul's cloak. When Saul went outside and was a little distance away, David said, called him and said, "Look, I mean you no harm. You were this close. See your cloak? You were this close. I could have killed you, and I didn't. I love you. I don't want to hurt you. Why are you pursuing me? Why are you doing this?" Saul would flip back and forth. You know, sometimes he would, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I don't know what I was thinking." And then he would go back to that, "I got to kill him." You know, he just was sort of messed up. He was messed up. Through the whole experience, David never tried to hurt Saul or his family. But since Saul was not didn't have God with him anymore. There was a battle, and they were losing badly. And Saul, rather than being captured, decided that he tried to get his servant to kill him, and the servant wouldn't do it. So it says that Saul fell upon the sword himself. So he killed himself. And then, after Saul was finally gone, then David stepped forward. There were some others who tried to claim the throne, but David stepped in and became the king. So we have gone from a wandering people to a tribal society to a monarchy. And to be fair to Saul, he did get it to be a monarchy, but it wasn't a well-run monarchy, and things, you know, just it wasn't good. But under David, the kingdom grew, and then David's leadership got the kingdom to be probably as good as it ever was. Jumping a little ahead in the story, his son Solomon was a successor, and under Solomon, things also were thriving. Everything would have been wonderful except for that thing with Bathsheba. If you know about Bathsheba. David was a good man. You know, he always went to God for advice and so forth. But there was a day that he was in his, I guess it's like a tower kind of thing or something. He was up in the tower, and he was looking out over the village where they lived, and he saw a woman bathing, Bathsheba. She was very beautiful. He decided that I want to have this woman. Well, he sent for her. It turns out she's married. She was married to a man named Uriah, a soldier who was out on the battlefield. But in the verbiage of the scripture, it says, and David laid with her. So we know what that means. So, Bathsheba went back to her house, but sent word to David later that she was pregnant. So David got a little sneaky. He called Uriah back home out of the battle. And I guess it doesn't say this, but my thinking is just the way he had it set up so that he could be with his wife, and then it would look like it was his child. But Uriah was a very dedicated and loyal soldier, so he camped right outside the king's gates, and he stayed there. He was not going to allow himself to go home. David tried to encourage him, and he said, "No, this is my place. I'm going to stay here and guard you." So David then sent, "Okay, well, thank you." You know, they had a banquet kind of thing, and he sent him back out into battle, onto the battlefield. And worse, he sent him to the front line. He contacted some of the military leaders, and they put him right up in front, stuck him out there, and of course, he was killed. So now he has taken Uriah's wife and Uriah's life. A prophet named Nathan came to see David and told him, "What you've done is not good. God is not very happy with what you have done. This is a really bad thing." There's a VeggieTale story about this. It's called King George and His Rubber Ducky. And it's really cute, where King George has a whole cabinet of rubber duckies. David had a lot of wives, you know. King George had a whole lot of rubber duckies, but he wanted that one particular rubber ducky. And then when the prophet came, said, "You shouldn't have done that." Well, likewise, when Nathan went to see David and told him, you know, "You should not have done that," David was remorseful about what he had done, and I believe he loved Bathsheba. Nathan said there will be consequences, and there were. The consequence was that the child would die, and it did. But they went on, later in the story, they did have another child. They had Solomon. So David, except for the Bathsheba thing, was a good man. He did just an amazing job of leading this new kingdom, this new people. He did really good things. And there's there's more. I mean, if we just look at the story part of it, there's a moral. The moral certainly is, if like David, meaning love, beloved, if we can continue to always turn to God, then things will go well with us. Not that tough things don't happen, because they do, but we're better able, because God is with us, better able to get through all of that. So there's that message. And as we do each week, we've been looking at the metaphysics of the stories too, to see how can this help me today? What does this mean? We all have these aspects of ourselves. So we all have a David aspect. We all have beloved. And it represents, it means metaphysically, it represents divine love individualized in human consciousness. Divine love individualized in each of us, in our human consciousness. And then, therefore, then it represents that power to harmonize. Remember when David was playing the lyre and it would soothe Saul and his turmoil? Love will do that when we are upset, when we're frightened, anything that is going on with us, love will overcome it. Samuel, he was a pretty key character, because he anointed first Saul and then David. He represents spiritual discernment, conscious contact with God. So it was Samuel that because of his guidance, chose, anointed, and so our spiritual discernment comes from that conscious contact with God always. The part of us that is in contact with God blesses or anoints the power of love in us, in our consciousness. Saul, as you might guess, represents will, you know, personal will, and functioning in the limits of personality. It says, when we read in the Bible that God withdrew from Saul, just came apart from him, we can interpret that we will have very limited success in what we do in our lives. There are some scriptures that are favorites of mine. One of them is, it is not I, but the Christ within who does the work. Speaks to this. It isn't, you know, and with our human selves, we can do very little. With God, all things are possible. And it is the Christ within who does the work. So all of those things attest to that. Saul acted from his own personal will, which caused him to lose the things he desired. He didn't have a spiritual source. Jerusalem. Didn't mention this part, but David established Jerusalem as the capital. And it was the political place first. And then second, he had gone to retrieve the Ark of the Covenant, and he brought it back to Jerusalem. And so then Jerusalem became not only the political capital, but also the spiritual capital, because it was a big thing for the Jewish people to have the Ark there in their city. So it says Jerusalem, David called it the city of David, represents a dwelling place of peace. So we, you know, those times when we meditate, those times when we get to that place of peace, regardless of what's going on in the outer, that's our Jerusalem. That's that place of peace. It says David made this city his capital, which can be interpreted to mean that our Christ self, that place, is home, a home in peace. Goliath is thought to mean, is considered to be thoughts and errors, thoughts in error. Now that sounds pretty tame, thoughts in error. But sometimes those thoughts that we have can be very frightening. They can be, if you get a diagnosis of something that's a cancer or something that's a very frightening thought. If you lose a job, if you find out news about someone in your family, you know, there are things that we find out about that come into our lives, our worlds, and depending on the thoughts that we have, they can be big and they can be very, very scary. So those are represented by Goliath. David, or divine love, faced error thoughts. Goliath resisted all notions of power. Little bitty David, great big Goliath, and he destroyed them. And we can do the same. That love that David is, that love in us, will overcome. Will overcome. Solomon. We just barely touched on Solomon, but he is the offspring of David and Bathsheba. He represents wholeness, completeness, and peace. And so it says the union of David, divine love, with Bathsheba, who represents fulfillment, produced the son or offspring, Solomon. Completeness and peace. So if we look at the story then, it can mean that our conscious contact with God blesses us, makes us be able to move through life much more easily, much more courageously. We have a personal will that needs to be overcome and managed, and often the yearning for spiritual meaning in life will aid us in that overcoming, that wanting to be at one with God. Error thoughts that seem insurmountable and frightening can be rendered powerless. And peace is the natural state of us, of our consciousness, our spiritual consciousness. When we allow physical, material things to pull us from our centeredness, we lose that access to our spiritual place. But when we make that contact again, then we're back in Jerusalem, back to the peaceful place. The release of these things will allow us to be centered again, and when we allow divine love to fulfill itself, the result is wholeness. David's story is one of the few where he, you know, except for Bathsheba, he's a good guy throughout the whole thing. He doesn't let power overwhelm him or turn him. He is love all the way through. And I think that, for me, that is one of the best things that I take away from this story, is that love never departs. It's always there. That God is always there, and that love that is God, that is us in expression or can be, is always present. And it's a good story. It's a powerful story. And we can follow it. And so it is. Let's take time now to practice our conscious contact. Practice the presence. If you would, allow yourself to just become fully present here and now, to relax and to be still. To be still in our bodies and to be still in our minds. One way that we can better accomplish that, to turn our focus away from all of the distractors, is to focus on our breath. We notice the breath as it comes in and it goes out. We breathe in deeply and slowly, hold it for a second, and release. It's almost like our minds, when we have something to focus on, cease for a little bit their chatter. And so now we just breathe and we watch the breath. We notice the breath and we are still. As we continue to breathe, we can feel ourselves relaxing even more. We lose all sense of what is going to happen this afternoon or this week, to become present, to become still. And it is in that stillness, in that place of quiet, we can feel that energy, that life that is in us. Sometimes we feel it moving. Sometimes when I bring a person that I love to mind, I invite you to do that now. Someone that you really love, focus on that person. And I can feel what I have heard, an expression of a heart swell. Just an almost feels like an expansion in my chest when I think about, when I feel the love that I have for my family. Love is not outside us to be gained by someone's attentions. Love is already present in us, and it is when we become still that we feel it, that we connect with it. And then as we are focused on love, it becomes like a mirror, so that when we see it in other people, when we feel it in the people that we love, it just intensifies. It grows in us, expanding. So we become loving presences in our world. The beauty of taking time like this to be still and to feel and experience this love is that with practice it comes more quickly, it comes more easily, and we can practice love in expression anywhere we are. Right here and right now, we are still, and we are love. As we do each week, we take time in stillness to be at one with our Creator, to be peace, to be joy, and to be love. So now for a few moments in stillness, let us be love in the silence. Often what we find is when we take times like this to be still, to be in connection with God, we come back from these times filled with whatever we need in that moment. If we have been worried, we come back peaceful, hopeful. If we have been fearful, we come back more courageous. If we have been sad, we come back comforted, strengthened, much lighter. And if we have felt alone, we come back feeling loved and loving. We are grateful. Not only are we grateful for these times, this time and the times that we take of oneness, but we're grateful for the awareness that God is always present. It's as if we are swimming in an ocean of God, always. And it is in the recognition and the awareness and the calling forth of those attitudes that we can be expressions of God in our world. And so we come back into this room, into this time, refreshed, grateful, and loving. And so in that gratitude and in love, let us join together as we affirm and pray our Lord's Prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.